BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's 748 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And we are going to talk about these recent comments from Vladimir Putin.
They need to understand, once and for all, that we have weapons too, that can strike targets on their territory. And everything they think up and scare the world with risks a nuclear conflict and the end of civilization.
Vladimir Putin was speaking in his State of the Nation address on the 29th of February, when he also said that Russia's nuclear arsenal was in a state of full combat readiness. So this is how nuclear deterrence works. It's a way of intimidating your enemy into inaction or possibly retreat. It's not the first time he's made such threats. And whether or not Russia is completely prepared to use nuclear weapons is a completely different question, which we're going to discuss in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, it is a frightening thought. We have talked about it since the full-scale invasion, because literally within 3 or 4 days, President Putin had put his nuclear weapons on high alert. So we discussed it then. It's just as frightening now. In this episode, we're going to discuss how seriously we take these threats. Would President Putin ever really push the nuclear button? What are the checks and balances? We've got a leading arms control expert who's a friend of the podcast and a former Russian diplomat who quit his post following the full-scale invasion.
This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Ukraine is an epicenter of unbearable heartache and pain.
Millions of people are without heating, without water.
Putin is the aggressor.
He will be ready to use nuclear weapons.
They killed him and fled.
I do not know how we managed to survive.
I want people to know the truth.
Hello, this is Victoria Derbyshire in the Ukrainecast studio.
And this is Vitaly Shevchenko, also in the Ukrainecast studio.
A bit later on in this edition of Ukrainecast, we're going to talk about how the Pope has been causing absolute uproar in Ukraine. But first, let's get straight into whether Mr. Putin would ever use nuclear weapons. So let's introduce you to friend of the podcast, Dr. Patricia Lewis, a nuclear physicist and arms control expert with the Chatham House think tank, which is a foreign affairs think tank. Patricia, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. A bit wet here in London at the moment.
Welcome back to Ukrainecast.
Hi, Patricia. Oh, and also joining us via the wonders of video technology is Boris Bondarev, former diplomat with the Russian Foreign Ministry, who quit his post after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Здравствуйте, Борис.
Здравствуйте.
Welcome to Ukrainecast. Patricia, let's start with you. Some quick questions to update our listeners on, for example, the state of Russia's nuclear arsenal right now.
Right. Well, you've asked that at a very good time because the Federation of American Scientists, which publishes these figures, bringing together all of the different levels, has just published the latest figures. So what they're saying is there's a total of 5,580 warheads, 4,380 are operational, and 1,200 are retired, awaiting dismantlement. They've got about 1,558 non-strategic, which we'll come on to in a minute, and the rest are on strategic weapons.
So is that then, a lot? You know, just under 5,000 sounds like a lot, but I don't know how it is compared to the UK or India or the US.
It's about the same as the United States. They have roughly parity, but you're right, it is a lot. For example, the UK has some, you know, 120 to 130, similar for France, similar for India, Pakistan, etc. And China has sort of 350 and rising. And then the critical thing is that Russia is in the middle of a modernization program, and they've estimated that about 95% now of its stock has been modernized, which means they're on new launchers, they're more modern, they have more modern command and control systems employed in them, etc.
One question that I have in my mind, and it keeps being asked very frequently, is about the difference between strategic and tactical nuclear weapons. What is the difference, Patricia?
It's a term that came from the Cold War. And in the Cold War, real big difference was the strategic weapons were intercontinental. They were to be used in a massive war, and they were very large explosions that travelled a long distance. And tactical were more regional nuclear weapons to be used in a regional war and also on the battlefield. And I think today these differences don't really apply so much. You've still got those types of weapons, but whether they should be called strategic or tactical, I think most of us think that any use of a nuclear weapon would be a major strategic decision. Mm.
So what could an attack from Russia look like?
So the attack that we've always thought about has been an attack on Ukraine using a relatively small, shorter-range nuclear missile, probably of the size of the bombs used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, perhaps a little bit bigger.
Actual pictures of the atomic bomb obliterating Nagasaki. Today, British.
That would be considered to be a normal range tactical nuclear weapon. That's what most of the discussion has been about. Some of it's probably based on US and other intelligence, some of it's based on imagined scenarios. There's always the possibility, of course, that could escalate quite quickly into a European nuclear exchange and possibly even a US-Russian nuclear exchange. And that's the problem with nuclear weapons, that they're not subtle things. They cause an enormous amount of damage in the immediate blast with a huge explosion beyond what you can imagine in terms of conventional
nuclear. And then what, nuclear holocaust? The end of the world as we know it?
Certainly a massive damage to all species on planet Earth, yes, depending on the numbers. So even around sort of 100 nuclear weapons could cause, according to modelling, depending where they were used, enough carbon into the atmosphere that you would get maybe a 10-year famine. That's the latest climate modelling on nuclear exchange.
And can you defend against these weapons that Russia may or may not use against Ukraine?
It's possible that you could knock them out, but where are you knocking them to, and would they still explode, is the question.
Our listeners will know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and estimates are between 100 and 200,000 people died. Is that what we're talking about?
If it's on a city,
yeah.
Easily, yes. And that's in the immediate explosion. The long-term effects are, of course, we all know about the immediate radiation, and then, of course, the long-term radiation that comes in the form of fallout, which can travel a long distance. It goes into the upper atmosphere, so you think about Chernobyl and what happened there.
The Soviet Union said today that an accident has damaged an atomic reactor at a power plant near Kiev. It could be one of the world's worst nuclear accidents. The admission came after complaints
and it's
from
be far worse.
So that's really, really frightening. To me, that
it's
is really,
really
frightening.
Really frightening, yes. I mean, these weapons are huge. There's a reason why there's a taboo against their use. There's a reason why China intervened and asked Russia not to make these threats anymore.
Now, let's talk about the possibility of all this happening. Boris, when you worked for the Russian diplomatic mission in Geneva, your brief was arms control. The possible use of nuclear weapons, is that a possibility that's enshrined in internal documents and policies?
Well, if you have certain weapons, then you will have some rules providing for its use. Nuclear weapons are legal. There were four, as far as I remember, four main points when these nuclear weapons can be used. There is, for instance, such a provision that if Russian existence as the country is under danger. But the main point of all this is that Russian leadership, when it comes to nuclear weapons issue, it will not be considering any of these documents. They will consider only what they will get immediately from this use.
From your point of view, does this mean that Putin is serious about possibly using nuclear weapons? It's not just a threat, it's a realistic prospect.
If he sees a threat to his existence, to his power, then he may use it. Let's imagine that the West wakes up and supports Ukraine massively with weapons, arms, munitions, whatever. And Ukrainians break through Russian lines and defenses and Russian special military operation collapses. And there is a huge defeat which nobody can conceal. And in Russia, there can be some uprising, and even Putin's elite can be furious because these dark prospects for his rule may become very, very tangible. And then to save himself, Putin may resort to nuclear weapons. He may say that Ukraine must stop, or I bomb Ukraine and maybe some European cities with nuclear weapons, and you will do nothing to prevent from this.
Right. So let me bring Patricia back in. Using that example, if Putin said, you need to stop helping Ukraine or whatever it said, as Boris has just described, or else we're going to use nuclear weapons, what would the West do at that point?
Well, I mean, that threat has been made. And what we've seen the West do is respond very responsibly. I think Putin expected there to be people marching on the streets pleading with the government not to go any farther. But what we saw was the protests were against Russia. And I think that there are now plans in place in terms of response. I mean, this is an unprecedented situation, and they've had now 2 years to think about it. My understanding is that the initial response, the message to the Russian people, is it wouldn't be a nuclear response in the first place. I think this is the initial response, but there would be a response, right, for sure. And then, of course, as you rightly say, you get into an unprecedented situation of a massive nuclear exchange with, you know, we talked about 5,000 nuclear weapons on either side with the US and Russia.
I remember at one point Putin said, there's no point in a world without Russia. In his mind, Russia is him. Is that a fair assessment, do you think, Boris?
He's an old man, of course. He wants to have his place in history as someone who, maybe the only Russian ruler who has finally managed to pinch the United States at the face, to humiliate them. You know, a man has almost everything that anybody can dream of. He has absolute power, he has the enormous wealth, whatever. He wants something bigger. He thinks he can survive. He thinks that the West will be weak enough to back down. We will do as you ask, just don't launch it. And for now, for these 2 years, I can say that his point of view has some grounds. I cannot fully agree with Patricia saying that West has responded responsibly. If we call responsibility a weakness, then yes, it was a responsible answer. But this responsible response didn't stop it from further escalation.
So what do you think the West should have done?
What, for instance, the United States did during the Cuban Missile Crisis. They showed resolve. They said, either you withdraw your missiles from Cuba, or we do it ourselves. If you want war, you'll get it.
Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
They said it, and then Soviet government thought that maybe we've got a little bit too far. Maybe we should really negotiate. And that would be an invitation for real negotiation, not negotiations in Putin style, that we take whatever we want and you must be happy with what we leave for you.
Right. Patricia, are there parallels between the Cuban Missile Crisis and now?
There are parallels, yes. There are also, I would say, some parallels with the 1980s as well. In both of those crises, there were near use, right? Inadvertent use because of misperception, near use because of misperception. I do think that the way the West has been behaving in this crisis has been responsible. I'll take issue with you with this, Boris, because I do think that Putin intended to frighten, and it turned out the West was not easily frightened, and they're continuing with what they intended to do, perhaps not at the speed that Ukraine would like, and I would understand that completely. But nonetheless, they have not backed down, they haven't stopped supporting Ukraine, and they haven't reacted in fear to Russian threats. Now, if they react in fear by then starting a negotiation, you know, what happens to Ukraine? You know, where does Ukraine feature in all of this? You know, we're all waiting essentially for Ukraine to make these decisions. That's the country that's been invaded. That's the country that needs to make decisions about where to go with us. I mean, one of the problems we've got with nuclear weapons is that their use and the potential for the escalation of use and the massive impact is such that they self-deter. And that's, I think, what we do see in this conflict.
Boris, what's your response? Do you think Putin is possibly bluffing, and if the West shows enough resolve, he can back down?
Whether he's bluffing or not, it doesn't matter. It matters that his bluff works for now. The West didn't stop its assistance to Ukraine, but this assistance has always been very, very restricted. Because it's war. War is going on every day. And while the West is thinking about whether deterrence or compelling or anything else, people are dying, territory being occupied, and the situation on the front line is changing. And now it's changing not in favor of Ukraine and the West, it's changing in favor of Putin. We can say that, okay, he can take one or two villages here and there. It's not strategic and also, but maybe it's not strategic in terms of concrete military operation, but it's strategic in terms of how it influences minds of people.
Yeah, psychological.
Yes, purely. It's war from the very beginning. It's purely psychological. It is meant to tell people in the West that you don't need to fight Putin because it's not your war. If you do, you risk this apocalypse. So just give it to him. Give it this Ukraine, give it to him in, I don't know, Poland, Baltic, whatever. Maybe Alaska, I don't know where his appetite comes. And it works.
It hasn't worked yet. It hasn't worked yet, has it? I know there are issues with money being held up in the United States, but it hasn't worked yet. And President Putin hasn't won yet and may not. Patricia, can I ask a really basic question? Are diplomatic channels open between Russia and Ukraine in the West?
Yes, there are a lot of diplomatic channels and back channels going on, as Boris will know from his time in diplomacy. Mm. But whether or not they're making any progress, I don't know. There's a lot of talk about post-Ukraine war, and I'd love to hear from Boris how he imagines this would end. It sounds to me like you're looking at some kind of deal in which Russia gains territory. And if that's the case, how do you imagine what would happen next? I mean, so our big concern is keeping Ukrainian territory in its form. But if there were, say, President Zelensky and President Putin do at some point enter into negotiations, at what point then would Putin stop? Would that be the end of it? Or Putin, do you think, go further and start to look at other countries in the region? There have been a number of potential candidates mentioned. And I think this is the thing about the resistance from Ukraine being, if you like, the first line of defence for the rest of Europe. And that's been the sustainable approach, I think, from the West.
I say that Ukraine itself is not the ultimate goal for Putin. To conquer Ukraine is just an instrument for him to consolidate his power, to renew his old image of a great Russian ruler, of someone who gathered Russian lands and everything that he managed to do with Crimea in 2014. He wants the world not based on certain rules. He wants to rule the world divided into spheres of influence. He doesn't want to conquer the United States. He doesn't want to be the lord of the universe. He wants to have his own backyard. And so nobody, not United States, not Europe, not NATO, would ever dare to interfere. Because he, in his KGB mind, he believes that the only threat to his power may come only from the West. Because the Russian population is happy with him. There can be no protest at all. And every protest is inspired by someone else. So if we negotiate with Putin the division of Ukraine, he will feel this smell of fear in you, that yeah. You want just to do something. You don't want to go too far. Okay, that you can be convinced by brutal force that you cannot restore Ukrainian territory integrity.
So appeasing him by allowing him, say, Crimea and the east of Ukraine, that emboldens him and it doesn't end it. He carries on because he's emboldened. Is that what you're saying, Boris?
Yes, and not only him. Putin is not the only nuclear dictator in the world. You know, it's like a shark which smells some spill of blood in the, mm-hmm. in the water, right? There are a lot of sharks in our ocean, not only Putin. And they all smell in this.
Thank you both so much for your insight and for your expertise. We really appreciate it, and I know our listeners around the world will. Thank you very much, Patricia, and thank you very much, Boris.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So this is hardly uplifting,
I know,
is it, Victoria? For the second episode running, we've been discussing the possibility of a major global escalation potentially resulting in the end of the world as we know it,
yeah.
Really. And we are genuinely in uncharted territory, where a major conflict involves a nuclear-armed country.
Mm. Yeah, I'm trying to take some positives. I'm happy, for what it's worth, that there are diplomatic channels open all the time. And, you know, as we have seen before, China have intervened to not slap down their ally Russia, but say, you know, enough of this nuclear talk.
Reportedly. But looking at the messages coming out of the Kremlin, it's a stark choice. Give Ukraine to me or they bomb you with nuclear weapons. How do you deal with that? I'm not entirely clear.
Yeah. In the meantime, while we're recording this episode at just after 1 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon, the BBC is reporting that, and we've mentioned one of these groups before, three Ukraine-based Russian paramilitary groups say they have crossed into Russia and are now fighting government troops there. One of them is the Freedom of Russia Legion, which we've looked at before, haven't we, Vitaly?
Yes, these are groups reportedly comprised of Russians fighting for Ukraine, and they have staged or attempted to stage raids into Russia before. It's still a very confusing situation. It's really difficult to understand what's really happening, what's PR and propaganda, but it just shows that these kind of incursions are a possibility. And these groups are claiming to have captured two Russian villages just across the border from Ukraine.
On Sunday, Vitaly, Pope Francis shared his thoughts on the war in Ukraine.
Ma credo che è più forte.
I think the strongest one is the one who looks at the situation, who thinks about the people, and has the courage of the white flag, of negotiating. When you see that you're defeated, when things aren't going well, you have to have the courage to negotiate.
E negoziare.
So is he talking about Russia showing a white flag or Ukraine showing a white flag?
Well, the way it was understood in Ukraine is the Pope wants Ukraine to show the white flag and sit down and negotiate with Russia. And of course, Ukrainian officials didn't like these comments at all. President Zelensky said, well, the most useful members of the clergy are those fighting on the front lines, helping our warriors, as opposed to sitting 2,500 kilometres away and pontificating about how to negotiate. The Ukrainian foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, he said, there's only one flag we're going to fly, and it's blue and yellow. So it's not something that officials are going to like.
Well, that, I think they were furious, weren't they? What did they do? They recalled, or they summoned the Vatican's envoy.
And a protest was expressed. But, of course, there would be people in Ukraine and outside of Ukraine who are, well, tired of fighting. It's not the prevalent school of thought, I have to say, but this has been going for so long. So many people have died, and presumably this is why the Pope made those remarks. And there's a huge number of Catholics in Ukraine. It's the second most popular religion after Orthodoxy. So a lot of people would be listening to what the Pope says.
One poll by the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology from back in December found, yep, the majority of Ukrainians are opposed to giving up territory to Russia. But the number of those who say it would be acceptable to surrender some land for peace has risen to 19% at the end of the year from 10% at the start of last year. So it's a minority, but it is slightly increasing. And on a future episode, we would like to talk about the role of religion in this war. Please send us any thoughts, any questions.
And our email address is, as usual, ukrainecast@bbc.co.uk. And you can message us on WhatsApp at the usual number, +44 330 123 9480.
Thank you for your messages, particularly from those of you who were following closely our last episode with Fiona Hill, who is an absolute expert in Russia, a former advisor to Trump and an expert in national security. This from Jean,
who emailed us to say that Fiona's interview was not dispiriting, but clear-headed and very much to the point. She says, I liked the historical perspective and the reminder that Putin's is a brittle regime, as well as the insight into Trump's psychology. The implication of the discussion that the West shouldn't just sit around waiting for Trump to be re-elected was very welcome, says Jean. I'm writing from Poland, where I've lived since 1988, so these matters are very close to me.
And this from Neil. Thanks for an interesting addition with Fiona Hill. The need for Europe to step up in terms of security and to understand the threat from Putin are key elements. This dreadful war is not happening on another planet, but actually on our doorstep. Let's not do the appeasement thing or the hope for the best, turn a blind eye thing either. No room for constant pessimism, depression and defeatism.
Please do send us your thoughts and questions. We value and read them all. And this Friday sees the start of voting in Russia's presidential election. So if you have any questions on that, please do get in touch.
And wherever you are listening in the world, take care.
Goodbye.
Ukraine Cast from BBC News.